Shabana Mason. She does a program here every Thursday night, so she invited me to speak, so I have to ask her what she wants me to talk about. How we're not the body. I could speak about that. There's one problem. I don't have any realization. In at least in American English, when somebody is very proud, or somebody is self-centered, or somebody is very insistent that they're right, we would say they have a big ego. Can't get along with him because his ego is so big, he won't. Doesn't agree with anybody, only agrees with himself. My way or the highway. But it, when we use that word ego, it's actually not the right word. Because all ego means, I think ego is Latin, it means the self, or the self-identity. So in Bhagavad Gita, it doesn't say ego, it says false ego, a false self-identity. So there's a difference. You have a big ego, you could say, well, that's just a big, so people, it's a big sense of who they are, but if you know who you are, then a big sense of who you are is not bad, right? Or it's good, because you know who you are, and you're situated in that. So in Bhagavad Gita it says, not a big ego, a big false ego, a false sense of who you are. That's it. So she's saying, speak about you're not the body. That's the false sense. Right? So now, every tradition I've ever studied, every religious tradition, teaches this principle. Right? It's not a foreign, is it a, it's not really a foreign concept. You have a body and you have a soul. You've heard it before? You heard it when you were growing up? Some idea? Everybody? Something? You never heard it? Huh? Not before. Christianity, they're pretty clear on that. Judaism? Maybe. Judaism may be harder because the religion and the identity are very closely related. So, the best way I could explain this to you is not to explain it, but just put you through a little visualization. Would you like to do that? Okay, here we go. Close your eyes. And you know, just breathe normally and relax. And just be conscious of your feet. Just put your consciousness on your feet. And be aware that you have feet. Be aware of what they feel like. Be conscious that they're there. Then gradually bring your consciousness up your legs from your calves to your knees so that you're conscious of your knees, and up your legs to your thighs. Bring your consciousness to your chest, excuse me, to your stomach. Be conscious of your stomach, be aware of it, then be aware of your heart, your chest. Bring your awareness to your arms. Now, bring your awareness to your mind and just watch your thoughts. Just be aware of them. Don't try to figure them out, but just look at them as they go by, whatever they are. You might be thinking, why are we doing this? But just be aware of what you're thinking. Why is Mahatma asking me to do this? That's a thought. Just be aware of it. Be conscious of your thoughts. And now, I'd like you to remember the earliest memory of your life you can, where maybe you're 5, 6, or 7, and imagine right now that you're 5 or 6 or 7, and you're looking in the mirror, seeing what you look like. You're looking at your little hand, and you're looking at your little feet. And just imagine you're aware of that little body now. You're conscious of your body and its size and its weight and what it looks like. And kind of feel what it's like to be 5 or 6 or 7 again. To be experiencing, to be aware of that body that at that time. And then let's move ahead. We'll move ahead about 15 years. That will get some of you in your present body, your present age. So you don't have to imagine, you're already experiencing that. But if you're older than 22, then go back and remember what you looked like when you were 22. What it felt like to be in the body. Maybe even imagine the thoughts you had at that time. Imagine perhaps you're looking in the mirror and you're 22, what you look like. Maybe you're a little thinner, more muscular. Okay, now let's go ahead another 15 years. So that might bring some of you up to par. It might take some of you into the future. If it takes you in the future, excuse me, now you're about 37. So imagine your body at the age of 37. If you're 20 now, then you'll have to imagine what you might look like. If you're older, you can remember what you look like, what it felt. Maybe also try to remember what it felt like to be in the body, the level of energy you had. Now we're going to jump ahead, 52. So those of you who are 20, can imagine, at 52, your body's going to be a little different. It might be a little bigger. Some bodies get bigger at that age. Maybe some gray hair, some wrinkles. Imagine what you might look like. You're looking in the mirror at yourself, what you might look like. You're looking at your hands. Now let's go another 15 years. Let's go a little more. Let's go 25. That should get everybody older than they are. So now we're 77. No, yeah, 77. Let's go a little more. Let's go to 85. So imagine you're 85. And you're looking in the mirror and imagine what you might look like. Gray hair, wrinkled, maybe you're heavier. Sagging muscles. Skin sagging. Maybe you don't have hair. Imagine the energy levels you might have, what your skin might look like. Now imagine you're in your last days of your life, and you're surrounded by your friends. You're lying in bed. The diagnosis is that you only have a few days left. And you're in this body. You know the body cannot live much longer. You're very weak. The organs are weak. Everything is shutting down. And now imagine you're no longer in the body. But you see the body, you're above it, you've left it. And you see the body lying on the bed, the 85-year-old body. And you're looking at it, you're looking at the face, you're looking at the body. You're conscious of the body, but this time you're conscious from outside the body instead of inside the body. You no longer feel it, But you're aware that it exists. Now you're out of the body, there's no pain. There's no weakness. Out of the body, you're feeling a certain kind of freedom, certain kind of happiness, certain kind of love. You're being embraced by divine love. Now let us come back into our bodies. We're back in our present body. And just experience your body now. Be conscious of it. Again, be conscious of your legs and arms and chest and your thoughts. Just be aware of them. And then when you feel comfortable, just gradually open your eyes. And sit for a few moments with your whatever realization you got or experience. So, what happened? Anything happened to anybody? Any realization?
It doesn't matter what stage you're in. It is always different from the body.
Doesn't matter what stage you're in, you're always different. Yeah, that becomes pretty clear. You're aware of a body. So naturally, the person who's aware is aware of something which is different. Yes. The person who's observing is observing something which is different from himself. Parshabhanavi, you want to say something?
I just want to say something about the first ego.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting to me, for me, it's interesting for the child, when I look at the 7-7, the ego is so, you can see, you're just there, and then when you become like 20 or when you're 30 or you're something you think about, you know, the ego
is how?
Very complicated. You know,
yes. They say when you're 20, you're worried about what everybody thinks about you. When you're 40, you get tired of thinking about what people think of you. And when you're 60, you realize nobody was thinking about you. Too difficult?
Yes.
Too many wrinkles.
You didn't want to be 88.
I think it's out of a fear. Something like that.
You're afraid to get old?
That old.
What am I getting old? Not that old. Okay.
When I was 85, I thought to myself, but I feel so young.
Well, I'll tell you a story then. When Srila Prabhupada, my spiritual master, was, I believe it was Jagannath Puri, he was walking with his disciples and he said, I came here after I got married and I was running up and down the beach. He said, and I still feel like running, but my body can't do it now. So, and he said the same thing. He said, I don't feel old. It's just my body doesn't do what it used to do, but I personally don't feel any older. I feel the same. Same spirit. Same enthusiasm. same person, right?
The notion that the soul was the same all through the ages is very difficult to perceive.
Oh, because you felt you were changing as your consciousness was changing. Yeah. Your consciousness is changing, but the person who's seeing it is not changing.
It's extremely difficult to perceive.
The person who's aware of it is the observer. That's the idea. Because you're observing your thoughts, and that's where you see your consciousness changing and how you're thinking, but still, you're observing it, you're aware of it. What about when we left the body? Anybody like that? That was the best part? The older people like it the most, huh? That's why I said come back, because I was afraid if I went too long you wouldn't come back and we'd just see you in the corner, your body and not you.
I can't believe that I can leave my children, it's okay,
yeah.
It's the problem, now I'm up.
I just saw myself die in a simple room in India, and I hope it's not just wishful thinking.
If it's your desire. No, that's good, because, you know, to leave you have to let go. I often think of that scenario. If we have awareness after we leave of people lamenting for us, but if we've left the body in the right way and we're blissful, then I think we'd be thinking, why are they crying? I'm happy.
Not why are they crying. I look at them. Always I'm taking so
you have to take
much care
of
them.
Right, right. Yes. Perfect. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, it's very good. And we don't live that long. And as we get older, it's such a good time of life, because we become more sober and we become more aware that we're not going to live that long, and we start thinking more about who I am and why am I here. So it actually helps a lot. You know, nobody wants to die. But it actually is very good for us. It really is. It detaches us, and if we're smart, it helps us become closer to ourselves, or at least inquire more about who we are. And why did I have to get old? Just like Bhagavad-gita doesn't want to get old. So then the natural question is why? If I don't want to, why do I have to? So it's a good question. I did an experiment once. I went to a college and I said, imagine I have a pill, I'll give it to you, and if you take it, you can live forever. And then I tried to explain to them the consequences of living forever. Number one, you don't know what the world's going to be like, because forever is a pretty long time. And you know, after a few hundred years, you might have done everything, and you might just be bored. Kind of the same old thing over and over again. You know, you've just watched, you know,
Empire's
20.
Gone.
Well, you've watched 20 generations pass by. You know. Every 10 years, everything changes. So after a couple hundred years, you've seen Madonna come and go, then you saw J-Lo come and go, then you've seen these patterns in the new movies, and this one getting married, and could kind of get old after a while.
Hmm.
I mean, just imagine right now. Just imagine for the sake of try to get this perspective. It's a very interesting perspective. I do this all the time. Imagine you were 1,000 years old, but you just look like you look now and you feel like you feel now, but you've lived 1,000 years. And all the things that you've seen in 1,000 years, would that give you some different perspective? Would you be a different person? 1,000 years of people struggling, fighting, people trying to be happy, empires rising and crashing. I mean, what perspective you'd have? Well, yeah, you wouldn't. If you, you'd be the wisest teacher of Bhagavad Gita in 1,000 years.
Perhaps you'll understand it eventually.
Yeah.
I will understand.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, I asked the kids, you know. Try to think, you know, would you really want to stay here? I have the pill. I said, so, who wants the pill? Raise your hand. And nobody would raise their hand. I said, how many of you would like to die right now? I have another pill. I'll kill you. Nobody raised their hand. So I said, okay, we have a problem. I said, I have a problem. I can't figure this out. You don't want to die. You don't want to live. What's going on here? And so, you know, we would discuss it. What does it mean? And, you know, by discussing it and saying, well, I don't want to die, but I don't really want to live here. I mean, I wouldn't mind living somewhere else that's better than this. Beverly Hills, maybe. I don't know. Better than Beverly Hills. So, it's an interesting concept. So then I said, well, if you don't want to die and you don't want to live forever here, what do you think that means? And so, you know, we would discuss and people would say, well, maybe there's a part of me that doesn't die and that's why I don't want to die. Maybe there's something in me that keeps going and therefore this concept of dying is just, I don't accept it. Yeah, it's unnatural. It doesn't feel right. It's like, I'm here, why should I not be here? I exist. What's the point of existing if I don't exist? You know, 50 years from now. So, you know, we would discuss these ideas. And then I would throw the idea out to them and say, well, what don't you like about this world? And they would tell me all the things they don't like about it. I don't like that I have to die. I don't like that people are unkind. I don't like inflation. I don't like war. It's a whole list. I'd say, well, if you could make the world better, how would you make it? Let's design it. You're the new engineers. You can do anything you want. So they'd say, we'd make it like this. Nobody'd have to work anymore. Food just falls from the trees onto your table. You don't have to cook. You know, everybody has friends that they love, and the friends love them, and happy families, and on and on and on. So we'd make two charts. So then I'd say, well, what do you think this means? And as they looked at the chart, of all the things in this world they didn't like, they realized this is not really exactly the world they'd want to be in. And then they looked at the world that they liked and they said, that world's better. I could handle that one for an eternity. That one looks pretty good. They said, well, what does that mean? Then we have to discuss that. Then they'd start to say, well, I guess it means that it's not perfect here. And then we'd have to ask, why? And then they'd say, well, maybe that other world exists. And they'd have to, you know, just question and look at these ideas. So interesting meditations. So as you get older and you have experiences in life and you question why things are the way they are and why I have to get old, I don't want to, and things are not perfect and there's war in this, then sometimes you ask, Why? Right? To something better. I mean, I could think of something a lot better. And then you have to think, well, does that exist? Does the better exist? Now, you want to hear something really cool? Who wants to hear something cool? This is so cool. It's so simple, but it's so cool. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, the nature of the soul is that it doesn't die, and it's blissful, and it's fully enlightened. It has all knowledge. Pretty cool, huh? And we're the soul. Go, hey, I'm pretty cool. I'm blissful, I'm enlightened, and I'm eternal. Pretty cool, right? What if the soul wasn't eternal? You say, well, we do this experiment, and we're looking at the body, and we realize, well, somebody in there is looking. Somebody's different, somebody's conscious. Then I give you the bad news and say, well, that somebody's also going to die when you die. But you get the good news that somebody doesn't die when your body dies, because that somebody's not, is who you are, and that somebody's eternal. That's good news, isn't it? For all those of you who don't like dying, it's good news. Isn't it? I first heard this when I was 19. I was in college. I went to a lecture, explained this exact principle, that you don't die. I said, that's the coolest thing I've heard all day. You don't die. Wow, that's good news. What if the soul died along with the body? Okay, you're the soul. Okay, I'm not the body, I'm the soul. But what if the soul died when the body died? And then the second thing is the soul's blissful. What if the soul was miserable? What if when you became self-realized, you became miserable? Because you realized who you are and you realized the soul was misery. Well, that would be like horrible, wouldn't it? God decided to make you miserable. Your very nature is miserable. No, but your very nature is blissful. So when you realize who you are, you become blissful. You don't become miserable. Most of us have heard that, but we actually think of it in this respect. You think, well, that's really kindness. That's who we are. We're blissful. That's our nature. We don't die and we're blissful. Okay, I like to live forever. That's good. And I like to be blissful forever. Right? I don't want to live forever and be miserable. I'd rather die forever if I'm going to be miserable. So that's the good news. It's good news, right? That your very nature is blissful. Now, it's a nice story. Would you like to hear a story? I'll tell you even if you don't want to hear it. Okay. Long, long ago in days of yore, there was a young boy who was enlightened. He was born enlightened. And so he was walking down the street and he said, he saw somebody, and the person was very, very happy. He wasn't doing anything. He was just living simply. He said, yo, dude, what's up? No, he said, he was a saintly person. He said, what's going on here? You're not working, you're not doing anything, you're happy. And he said, yeah, I was noticing one of these sadhus, you know, he's a sadhu, means he's a saint, and he'd lived a very long life. He said, yeah, I've been noticing this phenomena going on through the generations, that the more people try to become happy, the more unhappy they become. So I just kind of gave up. I'm doing really good now. So later on, in this book, Srimad Bhagavatam, in the teachings of Prahlad, he gives his formula for being happy. He said, it's really easy to be happy. He said, don't try. Because as soon as you try, you alienate yourself from the realization that you're different from the body, because you're trying to make the body happy. When you as a soul are happy. Have you ever had that experience? I had that experience when I was a kid. I try to fix things, and I'm really bad at fixing things. So what do you think happened?
Disappointment.
Not only disappointment. I was disappointed when I ruined it trying to fix it. You ever, anyone have that experience? Try to fix it and you break it? Mm-hmm. I was expert at doing that. One of my talents. I'd ruin things by fixing it. And my father would see me trying to fix something, he'd stop me. He'd go, "I'll fix it." So that was his realization, Prahlad, that he got from this saintly person, that the more we try to be happy, if we do it in the wrong way, the more we suffer. So in looking at that, I was thinking, well, this is, you know, it's really nice because our nature is to be blissful, and that's how God made us. So we can be very happy without trying to be happy, just by connecting with who we are. And it's a lot less expensive, too. Right? How many workshops you have to take before you realize it? Okay, we'll try to contain all those workshops in this workshop. So what we're dealing with in spiritual life is, one of the things we're dealing with is understanding the difference between ourselves and the body, and then getting over the false ego, which is false identification. So I'm American and I'm a man. So what do you think I am? An Israeli woman? No. I think I'm an American man. That's my identity. I am blank. I am 62, I am American, I am a man, I'm Jewish, I went to this college. Everything after I am identifies myself as this. Isn't it? If you think about it, unless you say I'm a spiritual being, every other I am is a misconception, is what we call false ego. Now, I want you to say something. I want you to repeat after me. I want to tell you two things. And I know you're all good students and you can do this really easily. Okay, repeat after me. I am the body.
I am the body.
I have a body.
I have a body.
I am the body.
I am the body.
I have a body.
I have a body.
I am the mind.
I am the mind.
I have a mind.
I have a mind.
I am the mind.
I am the mind.
I have a mind.
I have a mind.
So which one felt right and which one felt wrong?
Both of them felt horrible.
Oh, you don't want a body? No, you have a body. But which one felt right?
Okay.
Have a body. So we kind of intuitively know we have a body. We as a soul have a body. So it's interesting, the I am, fill in the blanks. That's called false ego, right? So that's the first instruction in spiritual life. First thing to understand. The ramifications of understanding that are broad and deep and profound. If you start meditating on it, let's do another visualization, so I'll take a few seconds. Imagine there's a little rope above your head. It's a mystical rope. And it's attached to your head now. It's going to pull your body right off you. And all of us got our bodies pulled off. And all the bodies now are hanging in the closet in the next room. And we're all sitting here now without our bodies. Kind of a deep sense of unity now, because we're relating with one another only as spiritual beings, not as the bodies. Okay. The mystical rub comes back, but they put different bodies on us. So now I'm a beautiful girl. And the girl across from me is a man with a mustache from Africa. And the lady next to her is a little girl from Turkey. And you get the idea. So now we open our eyes and we're all identified with that body. And we start relating and we start to realize that we're from countries and ethnic groups that don't like one another. And we feel very uncomfortable sitting in this room with one another because we identify with that dress, right? As long as the mystical string comes and pulls the body off, we're okay. But when the body comes on and we identify with it, then there's so much connected with that identity. Now, let's do another exercise. Okay. I have to say something before we do this exercise. For those of you who may not believe in reincarnation, you don't have to believe in it, but you only have to accept it to do this exercise. Then you can go home and not believe in it. So just believe in it for the exercise. So imagine I'm a mystic, and I have the power to see what you were in your last life, in your last many lives, and I have the power to see what you will be in your future lives. And it's all in a deck of cards. How many cards in a deck? 52? 52, right? Deck of cards. And each deck is for each person. So I bring you each up and I say, here. Here's the deck. And I go, this is your 26 last lives. Gertrude Jones, waitress at the nighttime diner, and you know, there's a deck of cards, and I'm a mystic, so I can see your past and future. The card is 26 of your past lives and 26 of your future lives. So I'm laying these cards in front of you. Gertrude Jones, you're a waitress in this restaurant in Chicago, Illinois. Next life, Sam Walker, an English professor in London. Next life, you got a good name for a dog? Bowser?
Spark.
Spark. The next life, Spark. You became the dog in the same house of the professor because you liked that house. Okay. Yeah, so you go through and you're looking at all these different bodies, and then there's 26 future bodies that I can see you're going to have. What would you be thinking? What kind of realization would you have? What would that do to you? These were actually persons you were in past lives. Probably sober you up, help you realize that this is just another one of those. I was identified with those, right? Gertrude Jones, Sam Walker, you know, Moishe Pipitz, you know, wherever I was, you know. Anand Patel, I took birth in India, and I was like, you know, Gustav in South America, and then I was who? Polosky, Shmolosky in Poland, and you know, and you're going through all this, and you go, oh my God, I was that fat, ugly woman. Yeah, you were. And you know, and so what, so you begin to realize that now that I'm looking at these bodies, I'm not identified with, but I was identified with, and now I'm identified with this, and I'm going to identify with those future bodies. You know, maybe you're a woman, you don't like men, and then he shows you're going to be a man in your next life, because you're always thinking how much you don't like men, and you're going to die thinking about all the men you don't like, and you'll become a man. Maybe you'll become the man you don't like. Anyway, so I think if a mystic yogi came and did that to us, it would give us a lot of realization that we are in the body, we're looking at the world through the body, and in all those bodies in the past, we were convinced that that's who we were. Then it gets really scary when he says, Do you realize in your last life you were a Palestinian fighting the Israelis? And you realize in this life you're an Israeli fighting the Palestinians. Because that happens. Because in the Gita, Krishna says, what absorbs your consciousness when you die, that's the form you take. So obviously they're absorbed in one another, right? Interesting concept. But these things happen. How we're absorbed in thinking, we can become the very thing we're thinking, the very enemy we could become. It's very, very interesting. I mean, could you imagine seeing a, hey, you're Moishe Pipitz, the next life you're a Hamad Malab, you know, whatever your name is, you know, and you're, hey, what? How did that happen? Well, because I was against them. So, that would be very enlightening. If I had the mystic power and the deck, I would offer it to you. But I don't. But you could imagine such a deck exists. And it can go back for many lifetimes.
And these are just the human forms.
Just the human forms, yeah. So when, you know, when people speak of self-realization, self-actualization, spiritual life, that's where it starts. So the ramifications are broad, because my spiritual master used to say, okay, I have to preface this so I don't offend anybody, but Indian gurus, traditionally Indian gurus, the way they teach is by being very heavy and sarcastic and cutting. That's their, they expose. So when they asked him about the United Nations, he said, it's just a bunch of barking dogs. That was
you said that?
Probably. Yeah. In other words, he's saying, you know, dogs are proprietary. When they have a master and they have property and you walk by, what do? They bark. And why are they barking? Because you're walking by their property and they're protecting their property. Right? So he said, okay, we're identified with a body and we're identified with different countries, so we're fighting over that identity. Now, could you imagine you could go into the United Nations and give everyone the pill, and they took the pill and they realized they weren't Americans, they weren't Iranians, they weren't Afghanistanis. Is that how you say it? Afghanistan? Afghans. They weren't Afghans, they weren't Iraqis. They all realized they were spiritual beings. What would happen? Think anything would change?
They can close the gates of the...
They can close the UN. Everyone's fired. We don't need it. So that was what he taught. He said, that's the platform where people will get along. Now, let's look at another interesting topic. I find this so interesting. Prejudice. Because what is prejudice? What is prejudice based on? Well, one aspect of prejudice is you judge somebody based on their body, right?
On their
body. Now, I had an experience with prejudice when I moved from America to South Africa. Because I was engaged as a teacher, and sometimes in teaching people, you want to be able to relate to them according to what you understand would be their background, their understanding of life, their values, and so forth. So I had that down for America, but when I went to South Africa, what people looked like and who they were wasn't equal to the way an American would look. If an American looked this way, he'd be a certain way. But South Africans were different. So I would treat them one way, but they were different. So you could say that's a kind of prejudice, not in a bad way, but it was a prejudgment of what a person was like. So prejudgment means you already have them figured out, and you already know what they're like before you even know them, right? Where do we get these prejudices?
Education.
Where do they come from? Education. Where else?
Concepts.
From? Who gives them to you? Where do you get them?
Conceptual perception.
Imagination. Oh, you're putting things together and
all the media.
The media, yeah.
Parents.
Parents. Grandparents. Great grandparents.
Fears.
America, yeah, fears. America. I grew up in America just at the time when there was still apartheid in America in some places. Do you know that? 50s? Big problem when the first black kids were going to the all-white schools. Ooh, people were lined up screaming and yelling at them. It's really bad. Yeah, it's not like that anymore, but it was really bad then. And so people grow up in these families hating the black people because they think they're the body. So you see the ramifications of understanding you're not the body. It dissolves the prejudice because you're not seeing person as a body anymore. Right? You're dealing with them on a different level. So that is huge in terms of thinking about the world and uplifting the world and uplifting people and world peace. And without that, then it's only political maneuvering, which sometimes means war, meaning war. And then that's how you can solve it. Just kind of keep people away from one another so they don't strangle one another. So my spiritual master, that was his idea. This is how you create peace. You help people understand they're not physical beings, they're spiritual beings. They'll get along on that platform. They'll be happy individually. What? Spiritual beings, yeah. Oh, you want to make... It's time to cool it down. Bad connection. Hold on a second. The world is watching.
Is it going well now?
The connection is not so good. Try it again. All right. Okay. Anyway, we should stop. Does anyone have any questions? What time do we stop? When do we go to? 8? What? Go a little more? Well, I'll go more, but you want to ask some questions first?
I want to ask about the glue.
False ego glue?
The false ego glue, yeah. I thought about the deck of cards. And I was sitting in front of this mystic, okay? And he showed me, and I was completely indifferent.
In a good way or a bad way?
No, in an indifferent way. Like, okay, I thought, this is my life. I understand I have identification, false identification with this body. I understand, I totally believe in reincarnation. I see the old body, I see the future body.
So what?
I'm different.
Who cares?
And this is a frightening thought. Yeah. Even if it is being shown to you in a very bold manner, it's still, you are still glued.
what to do?
Continue practice and bypass it or go around it or whatever.
But also,
if it doesn't work.
But also, there's, like we were saying, there's so many things in this world that we don't like. And one of the ways we deal with all the things we don't like is to forget them. Alcohol is a very good way to forget.
That's right.
Isn't it? And often what we call happiness is just the ability to forget the suffering. And if we're really good at covering over the suffering or forgetting it, then we say, I'm really happy. And if you see life that way, that's not happiness. That's running away from pain. You know, hey, I had a great vacation. Why was it great? Often your vacations are really good if you hate the more you hate your work, the better your vacations are, isn't it? If you like your work, it's not such a great vacation because you're thinking, yeah, Mike, I'm just happy working. If you don't like your job, you have great vacations, isn't it? There was this man, and this was before cell phones, and he was going on a business trip to sell his business, then he was going to retire. But his daughter had just gone in the hospital. Unfortunately, he couldn't stay because his business trip was planned months in advance, and this was like it. He's going to sell his company and retire. So he goes to the meeting, and then he comes back to his hotel, and he gets a message from the hospital that his daughter died. So he calls his wife, and she's not home, she's not at the hospital, and there's no cell phone. So he just gets in his car, totally distraught, as you could imagine. Right? Drives home like 4 or 5 hours overnight, gets home, and his daughter opens the door. Think he was happy? Think he was happy? Yeah. So what happened was the hospital messed up, and it's another person's daughter, but they had the wrong number and they confused it, and he couldn't contact his wife. But taking my point, you see how distressed he was and how relieved he was. So he was very elated because of the relief of distress. But this person, by nature, I don't know if you know people like this. This person by nature who's kind of mumpy, grumpy, you know, the sun's shining, yeah, but it's going to rain tomorrow type guy, you know, he was like that. So very soon he came down and just became his grumpy self again. So the happiness was a temporary relief of distress, but his nature was to be miserable. So that's how we conceive of happiness when we're not connected to ourselves. In our culture today, there are two very prominent philosophies or things that the media has impregnated within us. One is that more is better, and the other one is you never have enough. Right? The media's got everybody like that. If it's bigger, it's better. And if you have more, you know, it's better than less. Right? So then everybody's running around trying to get more because more is better, and that equates to happiness. But happiness has nothing to do with those things. Happiness is spiritual, right? If you look at your own life, try to see how much of the happiness you get is a relief from something you don't want. And you call it happiness. There's a lot of that going on. Few beers, few cups of wine, I'm very happy. Now just look at, if a society can only be happy by drinking, just like sick. They don't know how to be happy from within. They have no substance. It's a sick society. If they can only be happy by shopping, well, I'm doing shopping therapy today. If that's the only way I can be happy, that's a sickness. There's a disconnect from who we are, right? Or I can only be happy by dominating. and controlling people. It's all a sickness. And it's a spiritual problem. It's not, you can just solve it materially. You can help it materially, but essentially it's a spiritual problem because people have identified with a physical body and they're trying to make the body happy. The body's not the happy, it's, you can make your body happy, you can be happy, but it doesn't last. We already are happy, so that's, right? It's easier. You already have it. You just have to uncover it. She knows. Right? She knows. Look at her. She's happy. She doesn't need anything to be happy. Right? Maybe she needs her husband. Okay, so, oh, that was the answer to your question.
Thank you.
I don't know if it answered it, but.
It did.
Oh, okay. What else?
You can ask that you practice for so many years and then are you really that happy?
I get asked that all the time, yeah, but no one believes the answer. Because I say, yes, I'm happy all the time. And they say, you can't be happy all the time. It's not possible. They say, well, stop doing things that make you unhappy. I said, why am I not happy? Because I keep running after this girl who keeps throwing knives in my face and telling me to get away. That's one reason I'm not happy. I'm working hard to become super rich and famous because I think when I become super rich and famous, I'll be happy, and I'm not super rich and famous yet, so I'm not happy. And, you know, on and on. I'm doing all these things to make myself unhappy because I'm expert at making myself unhappy. There's nobody better at making myself unhappy than me. I really have it down. I've mastered it. I'm really good at it. Right? We all are. We're really good at making ourselves unhappy. So I tell people, I say, yes, I'm happy all the time. And they say, how? And that's how. You're doing things which are ultimately causing your misery in the name of happiness. We've all done it a million times. And we'll still do it a million and one time. Because we don't know how to connect with the other inner happiness.
What about other emotions?
Other emotions, such as?
No, if happiness, it sounds like happiness, but there's so many emotions in life, how they're connected.
How they're connected with happiness? Emotions such as?
Compassion.
There was a psychologist, and he was asked by a lady who was experiencing some degree of depression what she should do, and he said, go to the poor neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And lady was depressed. She went to a psychologist and he said, go to the poor neighborhood and help the people. That will help you overcome your depression. Because if we become too absorbed in our own happiness, then life becomes all about ourselves. And it's impossible to be happy if we're absorbed in ourselves. But through service to others, then you experience a higher happiness. Through helping others, yes, through compassion. Compassion is a much higher happiness than buying a new car. Helping someone else become happy is a higher happiness than helping yourself become happy. Much higher. And that's why the happiest people, who's one of the happiest people on planet Earth? Who was? Mother Teresa, right? You know she was happy. People would offer her things. She'd say, I don't need anything. They'd come, want to give her money. No. Because she was a servant. So she was experiencing that happiness. Call it Sevananda in Sanskrit, the bliss of serving. So compassion is a very high level of consciousness. Now, as we were talking in the forgiveness seminar, if you're a compassionate person, you're in a high level of consciousness. If you're a forgiving person, you're in a high level of consciousness. If you're a kind person, if you're an honest person, it's a very high level of consciousness. So you get to live in a high world. because you have a high level of consciousness. So what you have or you don't have is not really what's making you happy, but it's your, the consciousness you live with, right? Because we live with ourselves. You've probably noticed that, right? You live with yourself. Have you ever said, I hate living with myself, I hate the way it, you know, because sometimes we think in ways that drive us crazy, right? You want to love somebody, but you hate them. You want to be tolerant, but you're intolerant. So we have to live with that. So a person in a high level of consciousness gets to live with high consciousness. It has nothing to do with what he has. Right? How do you say right? Yes? Can? What about right? Right?
Nahon.
Nahon.
Nahona.
It's too old to learn. Too old to learn what I forgot. I'll just say can. That's easier. At least my realization of having been on both sides of the coin, of having an endless stream of unfulfilled desires, but having material things that I liked and I wanted, and giving many of those up, not all, but some of those up, and getting over those desires, I'm much happier on that level, because then I'm not being pulled around so much. Compassion, yeah, that's nice. It's just that this culture has trained us to relate happiness to having certain things or being a certain way. This culture is so bad that sometimes we'll think if I'm kind, I'll be taken advantage of. If I'm compassionate, that people don't deserve it, right? So I won't do it. Nice, we say in America, nice guys finish last. You've heard that? It's like, if you're too nice, everyone will take advantage of you. They'll throw you to the back of the line. But the Bible says the least will be first in the kingdom of God. So from the spiritual plane, the back of the line is a good place. From the material side, the front of the line is where you want to be. Push everybody behind you. From the spiritual side, you push them in front of you and you're happy.
It's also, I think in some places it's a norm. People just
Yeah.
It's obvious.
Yeah, they say in Hollywood, be nice to the people on the way up, because you're going to see them on the way down. So be careful how you deal with everybody. And in spiritual life, when you go up, then you become more of a servant. The higher you go, the more humble and the more of a servant you are. That's spiritual, because it's opposite of material. Not necessarily do you become more humble when you go up materially. That would be rare. Not that it doesn't happen, but it would be more rare. We're freezing up. What else? You don't have to believe me. That's my experience. I'll tell you a nice story. My spiritual master came to America in 1965. He went to the Lower East Side of New York, which is Lower Manhattan, and that is where all the hippies lived. And somehow or other, he managed to get a storefront that was about this wide and twice as long. I guess maybe not even this wide. Twice as long, maybe? 2.5 times. And So he was teaching this philosophy, but he was the only one. There was nobody else. There was no organization. There were no other people to teach anybody. There was nothing they could see. It was just him. And all these hippies were all taking LSD, smoking pot, practically every day, in unrestricted sexual relations. And they saw him, and just by seeing him in his presence, they saw that he had something they didn't have. They all saw that, it was obvious. There was no organization, no big festival, nothing on television, nothing, it was just him. He was everything. He was the personification of everything he was teaching. And they would see him, and they would look at him, and they would say to themselves, "We're taking drugs. We're playing music all night. We have 20 girlfriends every week, and we're not happy. And he is. And he's got something we don't have, and we want it." That's what they said, and that's why they came and followed him, because they could clearly see he had something. They didn't know what it was, but they could clearly see he had something they didn't have. And that's how he started this organization. And now thousands of people practice this because of those few people who just saw him and said, "He's got something, we want it." That was it, that's how it started. And if you ever have the fortune to be in the presence of someone that exalted, you'll say the same thing. "He's got something I don't have, and I want it." And when you find yourself saying that, when you meet him, you can laugh and say, "Mahatma said I would say that." That's what you see. You realize it's not anything external. Right? Isn't it? And that's why in practicing spiritual life, it's so important to be around spiritual people, because you see they have something. You get inspiration. There's a nice story. There's this wealthy, wealthy man in India, and he's sitting out on his balcony. He's sitting on his balcony. He's like one of the... He's like one of the... You all right? Huh. So he's sitting on his balcony. So he's like one of the richest men in India. And he sees a renunciate walking down the street. In India, there's so many... We call them sadhus. They've given up. They've left home. They have nothing. You see them walking down the street. They have a little bag. They live in ashrams. They get some food. They do their meditation, their chanting, whatever. So he sees this sadhu walking down the street. And his wife looks at him, and he's with a very dark look on his face, and said, "Honey, what's wrong?" Or whatever she calls him. "You look so unhappy. What's wrong?" He said, "You see that sadhu?" He said, "I want to be like him." So this life of wealth, opulence, power. And he sees this renunciate and he understands. He has something I never got in my life. And I want it. It's a nice story, huh? It's a true story. You want to say something?
Hmm. You'll have to work very hard
to get that, yeah, to that position. But you'll have to work very hard anyway.
Okay.
It's the nature of life. But this is a good thing to work hard to get.
Yeah. To get rid of your
get rid of your false ego and Lord Buddha said, he said, the wealthy man is the man who doesn't want anything. I mean, that's the concept of wealth. Oh, I have everything. And he said, the poor man is the man who wants, who's in need. So that's a general description. But the wealthy man, materially, may be in need. And the poor man materially may not be in need. He may be satisfied. So you define wealth in terms of need. Did I tell you last time? I think I might have told you this. Someone did a survey, I don't know who, and they asked people, do you have enough money? People said, if I just had 15% more income, I'd have enough.
15.
I think it was 15. 15%, and I'd be okay. The interesting thing is, they asked people who were making $10,000 a year and $3 billion a year, and they both gave the same answer. If I just had 15% more, I'd be okay. So that's the nature of living in this world without spiritual consciousness. You'll always be 15% too short. This relationship, if it were just 15% better, it'd be okay. You know? Whatever it is, it's always 15%, you know, so it's like that. Isn't it?
I found myself saying.
Same thing, 15%, I'd be fine.
Yesterday somebody told me about this marriage falling apart, and I said, if my wife could only 10% of what I asked,
that's it, you got it. Exactly. I only had 15% more free time, 15% more time, 15% more love, 15% more acknowledgement. It's just, you know. So that's also part of the culture of you never have enough. You don't have enough time, you don't have enough money, you don't have enough love, you don't have enough friends, you don't have, it's all